are you? This is a question we ask most often of our young people. Now, I'm not talking about those adolescent moments when hormones take over and our children say or do things which suggest they could not possibly come from our gene pool. What were you thinking? You can't be my child. Who are you? No. I'm thinking more of the vocational question. Our children are becoming from the day they were born. If we don't see our likeness in their eyes or their nose, we soon see it in their behavior. Some of our best qualities and worst are reflected in our children. We soon discover they are a magnificent and terrifying blend of environment and genetics, intention and accident. Much seems predisposed, yet we also see a great mystery in their becoming. This process grows as they head off to school. The right word from one teacher, and our daughter will love reading and writing for the rest of her life. The wrong word from another teacher, and our son will question his math skills forever. Mix in friends, the media, the internet, so many other variables, and only God knows what our child is becoming. At some point, the focus shifts. While we are still asking our children, "Who are you?" they now claim the question as their own. Who am I? A question which at once offers great freedom and yet can be most debilitating. Who am I as a young woman or a young man? Who am I as a son, a daughter, a friend? Who am I as I enter into more complex social relationships? What am I looking for in friends, in dates? Where do I identify along the scale of gender? What gives my life meaning and purpose? What will I do with my life? Does it matter that I am a Christian? Even in the best circumstances, these are difficult questions. When you add in the consequences, real and perceived, of a wrong choice, or the burden of student debt, the difficulty of finding gainful employment, the thought of living with your parents the rest of your life, or perhaps the challenge of living with a physical, mental, or emotional illness, trying to answer the question, who am I, can feel like drowning. As wonderful and mysterious as it can be, the journey to becoming is fraught with peril. We see this clearly in our children. As they face choices about schools, jobs, friends, and so much more. But it's important for us to acknowledge the question doesn't go away with the passage of time or once we reach a certain age. The question of who am I is a lifelong question, for the journey of becoming is a lifelong journey. Whether we're 15 or 50 or 150, the question is ever before us. Our children are born, and we wonder, who am I as a parent? Or they grow up, and we wonder again, who am I, as our roles and responsibilities change? Or we don't get married, or we don't have children, and again, who am I? Technology is a young person's game. We turn 50 and wonder if we will still have what it takes to succeed at work. Suddenly, we're 70 and retired. And we wonder if anyone remembers or cares what we accomplished with our life's work. Who am I is answered much differently in retirement than it was when we were working. Perhaps the day comes when we are debilitated by challenges of body and mind. Who am I can be a more poignant, even painful question later in life. By choice or by neglect, the who am I identity question is answered each and every day of our lives. This question of our identity, who am I, is the question that shapes our becoming more than any other. If we give the question too much power, it can bind us like no other. If we pay it too little attention, we are cast about like a rudderless boat. So the question behind the question is important as well. Who tells us who we are? As I've tried to show this morning, the question, who am I, is asked and answered in many ways throughout our life. But who truly has the authority to answer it? Who or what determines our identity? Who tells us who we are? These are the questions we face every day. But they are also the questions behind Jesus' meeting with Satan in the wilderness. Who is Jesus? Who determines his identity? How does he answer the question, who am I? If you are the Son of God, two of the three temptations Satan offers Jesus, the first, the last, Alpha, Omega, beginning, end, begin with these words. If you are the Son of God, there's really no question. We heard a few weeks ago upon his baptism, Jesus is the Son of God. In a voice proclaimed from heaven, God says clearly, you are my Son, the Beloved. In you I am well pleased. Jesus knows without a doubt who he is. Jesus is the Son of God. Notice Satan doesn't challenge or question this truth. Satan is no fool. Satan is cunning. No less than the Creator of heaven and earth has made this claim. You are my Beloved, my Son. In you I am well pleased. Satan relinquishes the point. God has said, you are the Son of God. So, if you are the Son of God, the game is afoot. Satan can't deny Jesus is the Son of God, but perhaps he can manipulate or control what this means. Jesus knows the answer to the identity question. Who am I? I am the Son of God. But remember the question behind the question. Who tells us who we are? Jesus is the Son of God. That's not in question. But what does that mean? Who determines what it means to be the Son of God? Who has the authority to answer the question? The people had their own ideas. We spoke of those a couple weeks ago as well. Having spent 40 days in the wilderness being tempted by Satan, Jesus preached to his neighbors in Nazareth. They loved him. Their Messiah had arrived. God's promises had been fulfilled. Until they discovered he wasn't who they wanted him to be. I mentioned in passing their adoration for Jesus, short-lived as it was, echoed the temptations Satan offers. Use your power to help yourself. Bless us. Whether we hear the temptations coming from Satan or from us, they sound pretty similar. I believe that was Luke's intent. We hear of Jesus' temptation in the wilderness. And at once we think it's about us. We hear this warning. We must stand strong against temptation as Jesus did. Reading this story at the beginning of the Lenten season only adds to the understanding. Lent becomes our season of testing in the wilderness. We gird our faith. We strive to be like Jesus. But what if we're to hear this story differently? Maybe Luke sees us not in the Jesus role of being tested by Satan, but in the role of Satan, putting Jesus to the test. Satan tried to manipulate Jesus by defining his role as Son of God. The people of Nazareth tried to kill Jesus when they couldn't do the same. Could the greatest temptation, the greatest threat to our salvation, be not our moral indiscretions, but our desire to control Christ for personal gain? The temptation to serve Christ, not on His terms, but ours. Satan said to Jesus, "If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become bread." Where have we heard those words before? Was it not in Egypt, when God's people wandered hungry in the wilderness, crying out for food? "Is God for us or not?" they asked Moses. "Let us go back to Egypt." Satan picks up the theme. If you're the Son of God, feed your people. Is that not why they worship you? Because of what you will do for them? How often do we approach Jesus like his disciples and say, "We've given up much to follow you. What's in it for us?" Having shown Jesus all the kingdoms of the world, Satan said to Jesus, "To you I will give their glory and all this authority, for it has been given over to me, and I give it to anyone I please. If you then will worship me, it will all be yours." In the world's eyes, we are a privileged people living in a powerful nation. In some, this produces adoration. They want to be like us. In others, anger. They want to kill us. How much easier might the life of faith be if we could just get Jesus to sign off on our prosperity and power? "Bless America, Jesus. Worship our way of life, and all of this will be yours." Then Satan took Jesus to Jerusalem and placed him on the pinnacle of the temple, saying to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here, for it is written, 'He will command his angels concerning you to protect you, and on their hands they will bear you up so that you will not dash your foot against a stone.'" God, just give us a sign. You won't give us all we ask for. Okay. You won't bless our prosperity and privilege. All right. At least give us a sign to know our faith is not in vain. freed from 500 years of slavery in Egypt. God's people wanted to go back to their slavery because God wouldn't do their bidding. The people of Nazareth, at the outset of ministry, tried to kill Jesus because he wouldn't serve them. Until the very end of Jesus' ministry, the disciples were asking, "What's in this for us?" Upon the cross, Satan, or was it us, hurled one last temptation to Jesus at this opportune time. If you are the Son of God, save yourself. There, Jesus didn't quote Scripture. He didn't chastise his disciples. He didn't save himself. He just hung there, dying, that he might save us. Friends, I've spent a lifetime preaching the temptation of Jesus as if they are our own. And perhaps at some level they are. God knows I strive and fail against the temptation to sin each and every day. But isn't that the point? Jesus covered my sin and yours by submitting his life to God, taking our death as his, and offering us new life in return. Beloved, try as we might to tempt him otherwise, Jesus will never be the God we want. A projection of ourselves, a cosmic Santa Claus who gives us everything we desire and lets us live as we please. Jesus will never be the God we want. But Jesus will always be the God we need. A God who stands faithful when we are not. A God who loves us when we can't even love ourselves. Beloved, in this season of Lent, may our journey lead us a little closer to serving Christ on his terms, not our own. This is the only way we will discover who we truly are. Thanks be to God.